Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the second part in our three-part series, grappling with what is a fundamental question at the heart of a kosher home, which is how to navigate meat and dairy when it comes to our oven usage. It is not uncommon, and I think I spoke about this slightly more at length at the beginning of the first share last week. It is not uncommon for people to believe that in order to maintain a truly kosher home, you need two ovens, one for meat and one for dairy, and never the twain shall meet. And that's how you navigate and cook things. That's how you navigate the kashrut in the kitchen. And what we're basically going to be exploring, we began exploring last week and we'll continue to explore the next 2 weeks, is whether or not essentially that is true. And if it's not true, what are some other protocols, some other ways for navigating this quandary of meat and dairy in our ovens? And you know, very often as Jews, we have a certain reactive understanding of kashrut. Things feel wrong, so we think they're wrong. We heard from someone once, though we don't remember where, that something was a problem, maybe something was okay. We can't do that. As Jews, we're never afraid to see how the sausage is made. And we really have to understand the topic to as good a detail as we can do, given the time constraints. And so the whole purpose of this three-part series is to really understand what's going on, to really comprehend the potential halachic issues, how we understand them and how we navigate them. And what we spoke about last week, we didn't really talk about ovens that much last week, because to understand ovens, we first need to understand, you know, kashrut writ large. And fundamentally, the way I always like to think of it is that the fundamental question we are always asking whenever we encounter a kashrut question, whenever I get a call, oh my goodness, I put the dairy soup I put the dairy spoon to mix the meat soup. What do I do? The question we are essentially asking is, has it become contaminated? The halachic term, as we saw last week, is really netinat ta'am. Does it, is the taste, has the taste become mixed? Has the taste become absorbed? And what we saw very clearly last week is that while there was a time when perhaps that taste was a very real sense, nowadays we think of it more as a halachic concept. And so there are various halachic mechanisms by which we understand whether something has become contaminated, whether something does have a problematic taste, a prohibited taste to it. And the truth is, almost all of kashrut is a potential checklist of issues or leniences. So whenever you have a situation that you think may have caused a problem, you can pretty quickly come up with a list of all the potential issues that can be either solved or present a problem. And what we began talking about last week was one major issue, potential issue we encounter when it comes to ovens, because the first thing we have to recognize, and for people who were here last week, we talked about this at length, and we're going to double down a little bit this week too, but for people who weren't able to listen to last week's share, I do encourage you to go back and do so, even though hopefully more or less everything will be understandable just by listening to this one. The classic way we assume taste to transfer contamination to take place, we're only dealing with situations where heat is present, even though ostensibly, you know, again, think of your cold milk in your cold chicken soup presenting a problem. But let's assume heat is present as a typical condition. But the most fundamental condition we need is contact. The spoon goes in the soup. What is not a problem is if your dairy spoon is near your chicken soup. Now, that could be a potential set of issues, but broadly speaking, we're not going to worry about those. Simply being in the presence, meat and dairy being in the presence of one another, does not itself present a problem. And so if we think about the following scenario, which I mentioned last week, which is not something we do in our kitchens, but you have, on the one hand, you have a foil pan uncovered with a raw brisket inside of it, and you also have a foil pan uncovered with some mac and cheese in it, and you put both of them in the oven at the same time, you turn the heat up and yada, yada, yada. they're not making contact. The classic model of understanding kashrut has no bearing on that situation. Okay, there's heat, but they're not touching one another. They're in discrete pans. They just happen to be in a very, very, very hot box together. That does not present, that does not fit with the general paradigm of kashrut contamination. And so, as I said, as I share the source sheet, and the first few sources will be incredibly familiar for people who listened to the shiur from last week, we see that there is, in fact, a major potential complication to what I described. Even though there is no physical contact, there might be another issue. And so we read source number one, the Gemara in Pesachim. We have a dispute, a disagreement between Rav and Levi, two of the great sages, two of the great Talmudic figures. Amar Rav, Basar Shchuta Shamein. You have kosher meat that is very fatty, Shatzalu im Basar Nevela Kachush, and you have very lean, non-kosher meat, and they're both in the same oven together. Asor, it's prohibited. My timer, what's the reason? Mipat mi mehadadi, they flavor one another. So Rav introduces this issue. So he's using kosher and non-kosher in the same oven, but it's the same as meat and dairy, that somehow, if you place meat and dairy in the oven at the same time, even though they're not making contact with one another, the very fact that they are in the oven at the same time leads to them flavoring one another, cross-contamination presenting a problem. However, the Levi Amar, Levi dissents. He says otherwise. Afilu b'sar shchutash kachush shatzalo im basar nevela shamein. Even if you switch the case of Rav, you have this really, really fatty non-kosher meat and this very, very lean kosher meat. Mutar, it's permitted. My timer, what's the reason? Recha ba'almahu. Because the only thing that Rav thinks is causing a problem here, the only possible issue that could cause this cross-contamination is recha, aroma. The brisket aroma wafts into the mac and cheese aroma and vice versa, and somehow that contaminates it. However, Levi argues, v'recha lav miltehi, aroma is nothing. It's insignificant. It doesn't have that power to contaminate. And then the Gemara adds, aved Levi ovada beresh galuta bigdei davar acher, which Rashi points out is a chazir, is a pig. Levi, this was not just a theoretical construct. Levi was like, Rav, you're wrong. Levi lived this. He was once in the house of the resh galuta, and there was in an oven, there had been a kosher kid cooking in the same oven as a definitionally treif pig. And Levi was like, oh, the kid's still kosher. And something that I may have mentioned last week, but it's very important to once again restate. For most of history, the classic oven, think of like your pizza oven, that was shared between Jews and non-Jews. So again, the case we are dealing with, and the case we are more or less going to be dealing with for most of this shiur, is simultaneous cooking. The meat and dairy are in the oven at the same time. The kosher and treif are in the oven at the same time, because that was the reality for most of Jewish history. Rav and Levi are not debating a theoretical construct. It's not a thought experiment. It's reality. You inevitably find yourselves in situations in which you're cooking your kosher food, and next in the oven, in the same oven, your neighbor is cooking their non-kosher food. Rav says it's a problem. Levi says it's not a problem. And the debate surrounds the concept of recha. This is what we need to evaluate and we need to understand. Is recha, aroma, significant? That's the only thing right now we can pin on these two items in the oven at the same time. The brisket and the mac and cheese, the only thing they're not touching. The only possible thing we can think of causing the contamination is the aroma. Is it significant or not? It's a debate between Rav and Levi. Rashi comes along and says, "The aval gav the kaima tamai kaveta de Rav." Even though there's a lot of support one can offer in favor of Rav's position. Rav himself is able to suggest that he has a lot of precedent behind him. Hilchata kaivete de Levi. That the halacha follows Levi. So Rashi emphatically, explicitly states, Recha's not a problem. According to Rashi then, you have your brisket and you have your mac and cheese in the oven at the same time. No worries. You're cooking your brisket in your oven and for some bizarre reason, your neighbor lets themselves into your house at the same time. And, you know, while you're out and sticks in the oven while your brisket's being cooked, a pork, call me. I'll tell you it's fine. That's basically, at least according, that's what Rashi's saying. If you called Rashi, however that works out, he'd be like, it's fine. Rambam complicates things slightly, and this is a very important position to understand. Ein sos number three, ein solin basash chuta in basar nevela or behemat mea betahamano echad, you cannot do it. Rambam says, no. You're not allowed to cook meat and treif, or therefore meat and dairy, in the same oven at the same time. Even when they're not touching. Ah, we think this is because he's arguing now, oh, recha aroma is significant. No, because he says, if you do so, hare zemuta, it's permitted. This is the distinction I mentioned last week between lechatchila and bidi eved. The idea that, especially in the realm of kashrut, though it's in a lot of other mitzvot too, there is the ideal way to perform a mitzvah or to avoid a prohibition. And then there's this situation has arisen beyond my control. And I think it's very important to recognize this. The situation, Rambam, we'll finish Rambam and then I'll explain a little bit more. Rambam says it's fine. Even if the tray food is far fattier and therefore is contributing a much greater aroma into the oven, it's still fine. This reach, this aroma cannot prohibit. Only the flavor of a forbidden substance renders something non-kosher. Rambam's situation, the distinction here between the lechatchila and the bidyeved by Rambam, the ideal and the unfortunate reality, is, again, think back to this communal oven, right? Though next week we'll have reason to question this. But right now, let's just assume nowadays in our own ovens, it's unlikely you're getting into a situation where it's like, I wasn't even thinking. And I just put the dairy next to the meal. Or there was treif cooking in the oven. And it's unlikely. But think about, again, the world of most of Jewish history. Let's say you want to cook your brisket. So you go to the communal oven and you see your neighbor's cooking his pork. So Rambam says you can't do it. Right? It's not because he's validating reach being an issue, but maybe it's just a bad idea. Rambam says don't do that. Okay. Now imagine the opposite scenario. You cook, the oven's empty, so you're cooking your brisket in the oven. And then you come back an hour later, 2 hours later, and you notice, oh my goodness, my neighbor is cooking his pork roast next to my brisket. Rambam says, don't worry. It's fine. Just don't actively court that situation. But if that's a situation you find yourselves in, don't worry. It's not a problem because Recha is nothing. It's lav miltahi. We Rambam ultimately fundamentally agrees that Recha, just like with Rashi, Rambam and Rashi agree, Recha is insignificant halachically to contaminate. They just differ on the practical application of it. Along come the Baalei HaTosfot. And I whipped through this very, very quickly last week, and I want to dwell on it for a little bit more today. Because Tosfot, first of all, says, Mikan posik Rabbeinu Tam Korav. That Rabbeinu Tam, one of the great Ashkenazi authorities, he followed the view of Rav, that Recha is significant. So we have Rashi and Rambam saying it's not. We have Rabbeinu Tam saying it is. We do need to be concerned by it. However, Rabbeinu Tam then adds several interesting leniences, several reasons why, even if you do believe Recha to be real, to be significant, there are a certain number of situations where you don't need to worry. Ubatanorim, this is the after the ellipses of source four. Ubatanorim gedolim shelanu. And in our big ovens, our large ovens, near a demutar la'afot lechem im oto pashtida. It's permitted to bake bread together with pashtida. Ha'il umechusot heitiv, because they are well covered. Have ke'en shtei kederet, it's as though you have two discrete pots. Va'afilu paldunash. Sheyesh la reach chazak, and even this dish called paldunash, which has a very, very potent smell. Ein nira la rebi shehi aso, this still is not actually going to be a prohibiting force. Sheyesh avir meruba betanor, because there is a lot of space in the aforementionedly large oven. Vaha evel mit poshet, and the hevel, hevel is a very, very thick steam. So far more extreme than just recha, but a far more extreme version. Hevel, if it can dissipate, it's not a problem. So we actually have far more than just kind of three opinions. We have a far more complicated spectrum. Rashi is completely cool with recha. Don't worry at all. Rambam thinks, ideally, be concerned for it just cause, but don't actually worry. Rabbeinu Tam thinks you do need to be worried about it. However, there are some very easy ways to avoid it. One is covering things. The minute something is covered in the oven, recha is no longer a concern. And the second is a large, well-ventilated oven seems to reduce any concerns whatsoever for recha. If there's a very, very, very spacious, well-ventilated oven, we don't need to worry. Back to our question of recha. So practically speaking, what do we say? Practically, how seriously do we take this concern of recha? So if we take a look at the Shulchan Aruch, the Shulchan Aruch codifies the following. Source number 5. Ein solin basar kshera im basar nevela o shel behemat tmeya betanor echad. You cannot roast kosher meat and non-kosher meat in the same oven. V'af al pi she'ein nogeim ze baza, even if they are not touching. V'im tzal'an. But if you did do so, hare ze mutar, it's completely permitted. Va'afilu haita asura shmena harbe v'hamutaret raza, even if the kosher meat is very lean and the non-kosher meat is very fatty, you will notice that is a word for word, basically, repeat of Rambam, which is entirely methodologically consistent with Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch, not always, but very often, just copies the explicit position of Rambam. Rambam is one of the three major opinions the Shulchan Aruch tends to defer to. Rambam is one. Rif, Rav Yitzchak Alfasi, one of the earliest and great of the Rishonim, who also has the same view as Rambam here, that l'chatchila, ideally, you don't cook things together, but we don't actually, we're not actually concerned with recha on a fundamental level. So Rif and Rambam both agree. And the third person the Shulchan Aruch often defers to is Rabbeinu Asher the Rosh, the three great early medieval authorities that the Shulchan Aruch is particularly beholden to. However, then the Shulchan Aruch gives us two major leniences. The second paragraph on source 5. Ve'im hatanur gadol, if the oven is large, shemachzik shtemesrei esronim, to hold 12 esronim. So an esron is a measure. The best translation of 12 esronim is the admittedly unhelpful 600 eggs. I don't know if anyone wants to go to the lengths and expense of calculating that, but I'm gonna wager the modern oven is large enough to hold 12 esronim. Upiv patuach, and its mouth is open. Mutal etzalotambo. It is permitted to roast them together. Uvilvad shelo yigu zebazeh. As long as they're not actually touching. So in other words, again, touching is a whole different problem. Touching is direct contamination. It's direct taste transfer. Reicha is only, the aroma is only a concern if the oven is not large enough and ventilated enough. In other words, what it appears the Shulchan Aruch is doing is he's taking the leniences of Rabbeinu Tam. And it actually makes a lot of sense. It's like, if Rabbeinu Tam is cool with this, and he's the most stringent of all the opinions, then it bears repeating that it's explicitly permitted to cook things, even l'chatchila, even ideally. If you have, according to the Shulchan Aruch, again, your brisket and your mac and cheese, you can cook them at the same time in a large enough, well-ventilated enough oven. V'im echad mehem mechusa b'ka'ara o b'batzeik o k'yotzeba. And if one of the dishes is covered, it can be covered with a bowl, with dough, basically anything. Mutal etzalotam afilu b'tanur katan upiv satum. Even if the oven is small and it's unventilated, it's completely closed, you can take. What the Shulchan Aruch is saying is something that it's a classic example of, if you were to walk, and I should stress, I will make the same caveat I made last time. Please do not act on anything we've learned until we get to the final share where we actually understand all of the potential issues. But if you were to walk into someone's house and you're going around for dinner, and they're like, oh, great, oh yeah, you're chatting to them in the kitchen, and it's meat, and you witness them take out the brisket, and they also take out the pan of mac and cheese, and the mac and cheese is covered. Shulchan Aruch says, oh, that was completely kosher, according to this part of the Shulchan Aruch. And you know, even if the mac and cheese and the brisket were both uncovered, assuming the oven is large enough and well ventilated enough, and we will assume for now that modern ovens tend to be better venter, even though again we'll modify this a little bit next week, or maybe we'll be slightly more stringent about this next week, but we're actually going to assume that most ovens are pretty well ventilated and are definitely large enough. Larger than the ovens of the past. The Shulchan Aruch basically provides two clear situations in which there is no issue whatsoever with cooking meat and dairy in the same oven at the same time. Oven big enough, well ventilated enough, or alternatively, one of them is covered. Now, again, we don't. Our question is still using one oven for meat and dairy, ostensibly not simultaneously. But there may be some situations where, for one reason or another, someone might find themselves in a situation where they don't necessarily have complete control of the oven, and this is important to recognize that we have. Yet to see an issue. All we've seen so far is either leniency, not even leniencies, just the legitimacy of things we could never, ever imagine ourselves doing, or prohibitions of things that are so far from what we actually do that it's not a particularly strict prohibition. The Shulchan Aruch understands the topic of Reicha to fundamentally be not a particularly challenging hurdle to surmount. However, enter Rabbi Moshe Isserles, the Ramah, the defining rabbi of Ashkenazi Jewry. An important methodological point, again, we could have a whole share on the methodologies of the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, whereas the Shulchan Aruch tends to be far more beholden to the earlier great Rishonim, Rambam, Rif, and Rosh. Rama is far more sensitive to the views of the later Ashkenazi Rishonim, the later Ashkenazi early authorities. And so later early authorities is a little bit of a confusing term, but as in if the early Rishonim are in the 1000s or the 1100s, the 1200s, the later period of the Rishonim is, you know, the 1400s and the 1500s. These Ashkenazi figures who are rarely household names, though we've encountered them in Shiurim in the past, and they are very, very important. The Rama was far more sensitive to their views, and that ultimately often leads the Rama to being far more stringent in practice. And we see that here. The Rama says the following in source 6. So first of all, he makes a point that we've assumed until now to be true, but he just explicitly states it. V'hu hadin lebasar im chalav nami dina hachi. All of these laws that the Gemara and the Rishonim and the Shulchan Aruch have been presenting as relevant to kosher and treif in the same oven also apply to meat and dairy, which again has been our assumption this entire time, but the Rama is just very explicit about it. And then the Rama adds, V'nohagin lahachmir lechatchila afilu betanur gadol. And our practice, in other words, the practice of Ashkenazim, is to be stringent lechatchila, ideally, even in a large oven, ubedieved lahakel afilu betanur katan. But bedieved, if you're pressed into a situation beyond your control, you can be lenient even with a small oven. What the Rama is doing here is methodologically fascinating. He is accepting that the vast majority of authorities believe either the view of Levi is correct, aroma is never a contaminating force, is never a concern, or at the very least, that the leniences proposed by figures like Rabbeinu Tam are correct, he nonetheless advocates stringency, but he's not denying the kashrut of the more lenient positions. It's a very, very, very important point to dwell on. Even Rama, being stringent, believes that when it comes to the question, the concern of reicha aroma, uncovered brisket, uncovered mac and cheese in the same oven, when push comes to shove, not the biggest concern. And then he continues after the ellipses. So by the way, this is one of the, if you're familiar with a lot of the like, well-known practices of meat and dairy in the kosher kitchen. So for example, the classic, these potatoes aren't meat, but you can't eat them with dairy. This Rama is actually the Rama where he states a lot of the general major Ashkenazi laws or stringencies of meat and dairy, but I ellipses them out because they're not specifically relevant to our question. But then the Rama adds after the ellipses, Yesh Omrim. De'ein matirin reicha afilu bedieved. And there are those who say that reicha, the aroma, is never ever permitted, even in a push comes to shove situation. Ela im kein hatano patuach ketzad min hatzad olamala bimkom shahashan yotze. Unless the oven is open somewhat on the side above so that the smoke can ventilate. In other words, the oven needs to be ventilated. In other words, reicha is a, no one is denying that reicha is a real thing that exists. The question is whether it can contaminate. And if you really, really, really believe it can contaminate, you need a way in which you can get it out of there. And that's what the Rama is saying. There are those who are so stringent as to be so concerned for reicha that there needs to be a ventilation path for all of the smoke. And this is going to be an important point for us to just remember for next week, too, that we're using smoke as a proxy for reicha. But it needs to be able to ventilate. Ubimkom hefzed ein lahachme b'dieved afilu satum legamri. And if you're worried about financial loss, we don't need to worry, even if the oven's completely closed. We forget, again, wheat, as expensive as kosher meat is, we forget how relatively affordable it is and also how relatively wealthy we all are. But Rama, this is a recurring theme often in the Rama's writings, financial loss is always reason to be not to make the non-kosher kosher, but to be more lenient. There is a famous phrase from Europe when it comes to rabbinic ordination, which is that don't just look at the chicken, also look at the person bringing you the chicken. That when rabbis used to have, you know, people come to them and they checked a chicken from their farm and they want to know if the chicken's kosher. They're a little bit worried. Is this thing they discovered after opening it up invalidating it? So look at the person who's giving you the chicken. If they're poverty stricken, again, if it's truly a disqualification, there's nothing you can do. But if it's if we're being stringent, let's not bother eating this. If it's someone who that was their one chicken for the week, don't be stringent. And then finally, the Rama adds a couple of other important things. Ve'im ha'isur davar charif. V'chol shekein im ha'heter davar charif. If we have a davar charif. So a davar charif is, your classic example is onions. Davar charif, I don't really want to talk about at great length, but davar charif, the rules of all the other kind of taste transfer rules don't apply in the same way with the davar charif. We assume it's far more potent. We assume it absorbs far more easily. And so the Rama adds that when you introduce a davar charif into the mix, recha miltihi, we do believe the aroma is significant. So let's say you have your brisket uncovered in your oven. You have your mac and cheese uncovered in your oven. And onions are also in your mac and cheese. Now we have a problem. The Rama, unambiguously, we now have a problem. It's unclear how easily this combines with the previously mentioned leniences, but nonetheless, we definitely are in far more of a serious halachic scenario here. Until now, we've only ever assumed that we don't really need to worry too much about reicha. We don't really need to worry too much about the aroma being a contaminating force. Now, for the first time, the davar charif actually presents us with a genuine reason to be afraid. That being said, as I'm thinking this through in my head, Rabbeinu Tam already gave us several leniences, and Rama himself, as I now look, quotes these. Va'afilu b'diavad asur im shnehem megulim, and even when push comes to shove, even bidiavad, if they were uncovered, and one of them was a davar charif, it's always prohibited. Aval im echad mehem mechusa, afilu bebetzek ba'alma. If one of them is covered, even with dough. There's another way. Like again, nowadays we have much better ways of covering food. In the olden days, they didn't. So Rama says, even if you have kind of a very meager covering, like dough, mutter, it's permitted. So what we see ultimately is everyone agrees that this concern of aroma is fundamentally not the biggest issue. And it's really important to also remind ourselves of the entire case running through all of these sources. Meat and dairy, or meat and treif cooked in the same oven at the same time. What we are dealing with in our own kitchens is something very different. We are dealing with the question of whether or not we can use meat and dairy one after the other. To put this another way, we're now over 1.5 shiurim into our 3-part series. And all we've concluded is there are potentially a bunch of halachic scenarios that don't really concern us. Again, we'll come back to Reicha a little bit next week when we talk practically. But fundamentally, we've yet to see anything that really presents us with a concern. All that is about to change, but we'll just enjoy ourselves for another few moments of yet having to think of an issue regarding our ovens. But our situation is not brisket and mac and cheese uncovered at the same time. Our situation is slightly different. You cooked the brisket in your oven uncovered, and now you've taken it out, And now you want to, and it's, you literally, you whipped it out of the oven, and now you're sticking in your uncovered mac and cheese. Reicha, we will come back to next week whether there is any concern of Reicha here, but let's not worry about that right now. Fundamentally, our concern is something yet to be addressed. That the oven itself gains a meat status when meat is cooked inside of it. Not once has a single source we have read had any indication that ovens can gain a, for want of a better expression, gender. That they can be meat or dairy. We know this is true with pots, pans, spoons, lots of other things. But we've yet to see anything that indicates that it would be a problem with an oven. And again, it makes sense based on everything we talked about last week. Because you're not cooking the food directly onto the oven's walls or grates. Right? In theory, that is a very clear way of making an oven fleishig, though also ruining your dinner. Take the brisket. Don't put it in a pan. You take the rack out of your oven. Put the rack up as high as it will go. Then wedge your brisket in between the top of the oven and the grate and cook your brisket that way. And yes, uncontroversially, the oven's walls have now absorbed meat. The grate has absorbed meat. That's not what we do. We put the brisket in a pan. In the oven, and it's just in the space of the oven. Nothing we have seen until now implies that the oven has absorbed the meat of the brisket, so that when the dairy mac and cheese then goes in uncovered, the heat extracts the brisket into the dairy and presents a problem. Nothing we've seen indicates that until we continue reading the Rama. I made this as source number 7, but it's literally the continuation of the Rama. The Rama adds an additional important principle, and this is, we will conclude with this and then really grapple with this next week. Aval bezeh achar zeh ein lachush. So first of all, the Rama says something that just confirms everything I was just saying. All of everything is cooking meat and dairy together in the same oven, meat and treif in the same oven. If one is going after the other, no worry. Ela imkein, unless hezia hamachavat mishneha. Zeya, steam, emerged from both of them. Da'az asor afilu bezeh achar zeh. Because then it is prohibited to cook one food after the other. It turns out, Reicha was just a distraction. It turns out the real halachic consideration is Zeya, steam. What happens? You put your brisket in the oven. And okay, the aroma of the brisket is wafted. Who cares? However, the brisket's also steam, whatever it is, but there's a far more tangible, well, it's not actually tangible, but there's a far more physical thing emerging from the brisket. It's steaming, possibly steaming. As Rama points out, it's not necessarily steaming, but let's assume the brisket's steaming. That steam is now going into the oven walls and contaminating the oven. How do we know this is a thing? The Mishnah of all places in Machshirin. Machshirin talks about impure liquids and all of the different ways they can contaminate when it comes to Tumah and Tahara, purity and impurity. And the Mishnah says, definitively, Merchatz Tmeah, if you have the water in the bathhouse is impure, is tuma, zeata tmea, the steam is also impure. In other words, we consider the steam to be an extension of the actual item, and thus its contaminating force. Thus, the Shulchan Aruch actually rules in another place the following scenario. Machavat shel chalav, you have a pan of milk, shenatnu bekira, that's placed in an oven, tachat kedera shel basa, under a pot of meat. Hazeya ola, the steam rises from the milk, v'nivla bekedera, and therefore is absorbed by the pot of meat, v'osarta, and thus prohibits it. We see unambiguously, steam has the power to emit, to be absorbed, and to do all of these various things. The problem we have to try and figure out next week is this very thing. The steam of the meat is now going to contaminate your oven and render it meat, such that when you place your mac and cheese in the oven straight afterwards, that meat is going to once again be polluted. It's going to be emitted into the mac and cheese, rendering everything trafe. Not the brisket. The brisket's still fine. But rendering the mac and cheese to be contaminated. It's a huge, huge problem. However, and this is the question we will end with, there is a significant question to ask. We scroll back to our first source where Rav and Levi debated meat and treif in the same oven. They have this whole long-winded debate about Recha. And we just spent like 30-something minutes discussing Recha. Why did no one ever bring up Zeya? The person who brings up Zeya is the Rosh, Rabbeinu Asher. He's the first person who seems to introduce explicitly this concern. Why, when Levi is like, the Romans, Recha lav milti, Recha is something we don't need to worry about, why doesn't he say, but the Zeya's a concern. The Zeya's a reason to be worried. Why doesn't that ever get raised? And thus, what we will begin talking about next week is how different halachic figures grapple with this fundamental question. Is Zeya, as terrifying as Zeya sounds based on how I just portrayed it, is it really a thing? Or perhaps to put it slightly better, because no one really disagrees that it's a thing, bar one person we'll mention just very, very briefly, but more, a better way to put it is Zeya a thing in our ovens? Do we really need to be concerned with Zeya? And then after understanding next week, Zeya, together with Recha, we'll be able to look at a few different well-known approaches to this fundamental question of how to navigate meat and dairy in our ovens.